from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments next week in a case which challenges the mandatory union fees paid by public employees. The case is being watched closely by California business and labor leaders. A loss for labor would be a major blow to California's public employee unions, which could stand to lose members and millions of dollars. Voices for Reform have long criticized the status quo, where they say their state taxes go to getting public workers better benefits, including health care and pensions, than they themselves receive. That's next, after this. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The United States Supreme Court will hear arguments on Monday in Janus versus American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, a case likely to have major implications for one of California's most potent political forces, public employee unions. A decision in favor of the challenger would forbid public employees, unions, to charge fair share fees for workers who don't want to join a union but who stand to benefit from bargaining agreements that improve wages and working conditions. The state is bracing for a ruling in support of Janus. This could cost California unions thousands of members and millions of dollars and trouble those who think unions provide a necessary counterbalance to powerful corporate interests. Joining me now to discuss the case and its political implications for California are Marcia Coyle. She's chief Washington correspondent with the National Law Journal, and she's also the author of The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. Welcome, Marcia Coyle. Glad to have you back with us.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be with you.
And we're also glad to have our own Scott Schaefer, who's here with us in studio, senior editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
And we're going to essentially tell you what this is all about in the first half hour of this show and certainly bring you in with any questions or comments you might have. I should say that the Washington Post has called this the most important labor case of the 21st century. It does, in fact, involve 22 states. And later on in the second half hour of the program, we'll actually have a debate over this. That's how important and significant we believe it is. So let's find out what we're talking about here, Marcia Coyle. Janus versus American Federation goes back to a guy, a state employee in Illinois.
That's right. Mark Janus is a public employee, and he is a non-union member. He and some others decided to challenge Illinois' agency fee law, claiming that it violates their First Amendment right. Now, Illinois law allows public employees to designate a union to represent them in collective bargaining with the government. But once the public employees designate a union, state law requires the union to provide representation to every government employee in the collective bargaining unit, whether they're a member of the union or not. But the law allows the union to charge those non-members what is called an agency fee, or also known as a fair share fee, to cover the union's costs of representing those non-union members under the collective bargaining agreement. Now, I have to say, Michael, for a very long time, the National Right to Work Foundation has been challenging these fair share fees as violating the First Amendment speech and association rights of non-union employees in a number of states around the country. I think there are now roughly 20 other states, in addition to Illinois, that allow this. And they've been successful in some, but it was really the Supreme Court that sort of opened the door and even drafted a roadmap as to how to challenge these fair share fees, which brings us to the U.S. Supreme Court. Janus did not prevail in the lower courts because there is a 41-year-old Supreme Court decision that upheld fair share fees against the constitutional challenge. And so as Janus comes to the Supreme Court, He's asking the court to overturn, throw out that 40-year-old precedent and find that the fees do indeed violate the First Amendment.
And that 40-year precedent goes back to 1977 with Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, which essentially made this law for, as you say, over 40 years now. But we need a little more history here, and I know I can get it from you. Fredericks versus California Teachers Association was a 4-4 deadlock, and Anton Scalia died, and the result was that it remained kind of in limbo, but it was pretty much the same case, wasn't it?
It was, absolutely. In fact, it was filed in California by an organization here in Washington, D.C., and the case was actually, and they admitted to it, structured in order to challenge that 41-year-old decision. They didn't even defend their challenge in the lower courts because they wanted to get it right to the Supreme Court. As you just said, it came to the Supreme Court in the 2015-16 term. I was there for the oral arguments, and it did not look good at all for the unions during those arguments. Justice Scalia died in February of 2016, and when the court issued its decision, it was a 4-4 deadlock without him, and that, in effect, upheld the lower court, or affirmed the lower court decision in favor of the union. So right now, the law as it stands in the United States is that these fair share fees are constitutional. But that 4-4 deadlock was an indication to those who oppose these fair share fees that they just needed one more vote in order to undo them.
And forgive me, Marcia, I believe there seems to be a rather strong consensus that they have it now with Neil Gorsuch.
Well, that's what I was just going to get to, that there, the hopes are that Justice Gorsuch is going to be the one that seals the fate of fair share fees. We'll have to wait and see. You know, he certainly is a member of the conservative wing of the Supreme Court. He's shown that so far. And it's assumed, and judging on the oral arguments in that California case, the four conservatives on the court at the time were ready to strike down fair share fees. So it doesn't look good for the unions.
Marcia Coyle, again with us, chief Washington correspondent with National Law Journal, author of The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. Scott Schaefer is here to shed light on this, senior editor for KQED's California Politics and Government desk. And Scott, this is the most significant expansion of First Amendment since Citizens United, really.
Yeah, I mean, this has been sort of a slow-motion train wreck for organized labor. I mean, as Marcia just said, this case was before the Supreme Court in 2016, and I think organized labor at that time expected they were going to lose 5-4, and so they dodged a bullet, really, when Justice Scalia died and then Republicans blocked President Obama from naming his replacement. So they know this is coming. I mean, as much as they'd like to hope that, you know, one of the more conservative justices will uphold precedent, the Abood case, but I think they're assuming that's not going to happen, and they're taking steps to prepare. They have been doing, and maybe we should just say, if they lose this case, organized labor then will have to convince non-members to pay this fee. They'll have to opt in to pay the fee for collective bargaining. And so they've been doing some internal organizing. I mean, in the past, unions haven't really had to do that. The law has been on their side. They just charged the fee, and that was that. Now they have begun reaching out to members and new employees and trying to convince them of the value of opting in under the assumption that they're going to lose this case.
Well, what we saw, for example, in Wisconsin with Scott Walker was a definite public anger against the unions, particularly because of the money that went to pensions and health care and protecting teachers with tenure, all of those kinds of things. And they certainly play into California politics. I mean, here in California, for example, if they're going to lose on this, and it seems likely from our vantage point, as we said, that they probably will, given the court 5-4 with Gorsuch, they're going to lose an immense amount of money, and a lot of that money has gone into not only rights for public employees, but Democratic politics.
Well, there's no question that Democrats running for office and issues that are on the ballot that favor unions or oppose unions, they're on one side or the other of that with their political money. And it disproportionately, of course, goes to Democrats. They do, some unions do give money to Republicans as well, especially at the federal level. Now, I talked with a labor official yesterday who said, well, you know, that money is largely separate. The money that we do use for political purposes is a separate pot of money, and it wouldn't be directly affected by this. But anytime a union loses members, and they figure it could be, you know, up to 15-30% of their membership, depending on how it plays out, that money is going to have to come from somewhere, and it just gives a sense, a perception that the unions are weaker, and it could affect, the willingness of the legislature to take on things like pension reform. Right now, the unions have been pretty adamant, and their supporters in the legislature haven't bucked the unions on those issues. Charter schools is another one. And so if this decision goes against organized labor, you could see, and this is what, frankly, proponents of getting rid of these fair share fees, what they're hoping for is that you'll see more movement on some of those issues if organized labor doesn't have the clout that it does right now.
And the proponents are pretty much those in the Trump administration.
Well, I mean, this predates the Trump administration. I mean, these are...
I was just getting at the shift that we've seen from the Obama administration, which is behind this, and the Trump administration is countering it.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that this particular administration is more hostile to organized labor and some would say working class folks in general, based on the tax plan and other things, other appointments that he's made. But this is really larger than Donald Trump. You know, this is the Koch brothers and other well-known large donors to Republican causes and conservative causes that have been financing these legal cases.
Well, unions in right-to-work and fair-share states, according to some calculations, would lose their membership by between 15-30%.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned Wisconsin, and there was a big hit there where they lost a big slice of their membership. Michigan, a similar thing happened. The impact wasn't so great. So I think that's why they're trying now, organized labor, to get ahead of this so that, you know, when the time comes, they will have had already communication with their members. And they also, the legislature passed a bill that the governor signed that will give unions immediate access to all new public sector employees so that they can begin to explain to them why they think they should opt in to these fees. So, you know, they're trying to get ahead of it, trying to do some workarounds to mitigate the impact of this, again, assuming that they lose.
Well, as I said, we're going to have a debate on this in the second half hour. But in the meantime, I know there are many of you, especially public employee union members or those who are perhaps in unions or support unions or those who are on the other side who may want to weigh in here or just ask questions, especially information that is necessary as the hearings are going to be held on Monday. Let me give you a toll-free number you can join us at, and that number is 866-733-6786. You can join us now, so please feel free to do that. Again, call in at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Scott, you're going to add something?
Yeah, you know, I think organized labor folks would say that this isn't just about, you know, the right to collective bargaining and to collect dues to do that, that there are a lot of issues that organized labor works on that benefit other people, whether or not they're in unions, whether or not they're public employees, such as immigration, DACA, raising the minimum wage. These are issues that unions, especially in recent years, have been weighing in on heavily. And so they would argue that if that clout is diminished, that it's not just union members that are going to be affected. It's others who benefit from these other policies, like I said, raising the minimum wage, for example.
We're going to go to your calls. And again, you can join us at 866-733-6786, particularly interested in finding out what questions you have about this, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Let me just go quickly back to you, though, Marsha Coyle, if I could. And maybe you can talk a bit about what agency fees and fair share are and how you split political activity from union dues.
Well, that's really the very interesting aspect of the arguments in this case. When the court ruled in the Abood case 41 years ago, the court did draw a line between the money that unions spend to cover costs of collective bargaining and political activities. Political activities were to be separate. But in the Janus case, Janus is arguing that a public employee union, when it bargains with government, everything is political because government is the whatever branch. It's a political branch of government. And so there is no line. And they also claim, of course, that the unions have abused the fair share fees by using them for certain political purposes. On the other side of the case, though, the state and the union have said that's just simply not true. They've produced friend of the court briefs from auditors, for example, that show that these fees are very carefully marked, and the non-union members are provided with a list of chargeable and non-chargeable fee activities, so they know what their money is being used for. My sense of what happened with the Friedrichs case that ended in the 4-4 split during the arguments, it didn't seem as though the conservative justices were persuaded that the money could really be separated that way. And Justice Alito, who really has sort of been the justice who opened the door to these challenges, seemed to buy in particular the argument that everything a union does in terms of collective bargaining is political because it affects public policy and citizens.
Yeah, I think so, Justice Alito said it's almost impossible to draw a line between the two of them.
Yes, he did. That's right. And so in his last decision on this, he listed all the reasons why the Abood decision should be thrown out. And let me say this, Michael. The court has overruled major decisions in the past, but it's not an easy thing to do. I mean, this is a decision that is 41 years old. It was a unanimous decision when it was written, and there has been tremendous reliance on it in the last 41 years by not only unions, but by governments as employers. And that's what the state of Illinois is saying here. You know, we're acting as an employer, and we have a certain amount of discretion under our law to form these unions and to make rules for them. But when the Supreme Court does overrule a landmark or very old decision, it has to explain why that decision has to be thrown out. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see what some of the justices say about that. Because as you know, and anybody who watches Senate confirmation hearings for justices, just about every Supreme Court nominee pays homage to what we call stare decisis, standing by old decisions. And they do that because we don't want a lot of disruption in the law. You know, we want continuity. People want to know what their rights and obligations are under the law. I think it was Chief Justice Roberts who, during his confirmation hearing, said overruling an old precedent, like Abood, he didn't pick out Abood, is a legal jolt to the system. And you have to be very careful. And there are a number of factors that the justices will look at to determine whether or not Abood should be overruled. Justice Alito cited a lot of those in his last opinion, and Justice Kagan, in dissent, cited all the reasons why they should not overrule Abood. So it's going to be really interesting to see, especially now, how Justice Gorsuch, if he does agree to overrule it. It wasn't that long ago that also during his hearing, he pledged some allegiance to standing by old decisions.
Yeah, there's a conservative view that there's value in legal stability, and also it's ironic that the liberals are urging judicial restraint in this particular case, I think. but that's how these things often play out. Marcia Coyle, again, with us from Washington, and we're going to go to your calls here in just a moment. Scott, let me ask you, though, if Janice wins, could it improve maybe political gridlock over pension reform in Sacramento, for example?
Well, I think that's the hope of people who are opposed to unions and who think unions have too much influence in Sacramento and in Washington and other state capitals. You know, part of the reason that more things haven't happened on pension reform is because that's the ideology of the people that have been elected. The Democrats primarily who are up in Sacramento and the governor, that is their true belief. But there's also the other side of it, which is fear. And there's always a fear that if you cross unions or any interest group, but unions in this case, that they will primary you, they'll run somebody against you that's more liberal. That's particularly true under this top two primary system that we have in California. And it runs both ways. I mean, sometimes other business groups will run a more moderate Democrat, you know, but I think that the hope, to answer your question, is that yes, that will happen. It's not going to happen overnight, and it's going to be, you know, driven in part by economic realities. I mean, the current system is not sustainable as it is. It's going to have to be addressed sooner or later.
Well, let me bring some callers into this. And Adam, we begin with you. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm curious to learn a little bit more about what options unions may have to, you know, increase their leverage in order to maintain relevance if there are, you know, if they do away with these fees that non-union members pay. Are unions obligated to extend all of the bargaining benefits that they gain to members who are, you know, not going to be paying these fees? And are there ways for them to entice members to remain engaged through kind of different actions like
that?
Yeah,
it's a good question, and thank you for it, Adam. I think, Scott, the answer is, in fact, some say it wouldn't be fair, but that would be indeed the case. They would benefit.
Yeah, know? I mean, as I said, unions are proactively, I mean, if there's a silver lining for unions in all of this, it's forcing them to, they're sort of the under the gun, to create closer relationships with the people that they represent, either at collective bargaining or elsewhere. And so that is their hope, that, and to answer the caller's question, that they can, through persuasion, get folks to opt in to paying these agency fees or the fair share fees that could be struck down.
And let me thank you, Adam, for the call and go right to another caller, and that's John. John, join us. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. So this is a little bit inside baseball because this is all very technical and has to do with courts and laws and so forth. But the bottom line is, should unions maintain what power they have or even increasing it? And the problem is I support most of the things that a union would support, good wages, good retirement, and so forth. But the vast majority of people do not get the benefits that unions provide for their small groups of people. So I find myself not being sympathetic with the unions because people like me and the vast majority of people come to resent the wages and the benefits that people in the unions get, and it's almost in a way like I think unions are outmoded, and it wouldn't be such a bad thing if unions basically disappeared in favor of some other method of fairness for the general populace for all these benefits.
Well, there we go. John, thank you for the call. That's going to have to wrap it up for us because we're going to have a debate after we say goodbye to Scott Shaver. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Yeah,
on this.
Anytime.
And Marcia Coyle, appreciate very much your being with us. Thank you.
A pleasure, Michael.
Again, Marcia Coyle, Chief Washington Correspondent with the National Law Journal. Scott Shaver, Senior Editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. And when we return, we will get into this in a heated debate fashion, or more light, I hope, than heat. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and as I said, we've been talking in the first half hour, fleshing out what is at stake here in this U.S. Supreme Court hearing on union dues, which certainly affects California labor and certainly affects national questions of labor as well. And let me tell you who is joining us for a specific debate on this. Stephen Kreisberg is Director of Research and Collective Bargaining for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and he joins us in this half hour. Thank you for joining us. Good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Daniel DeSalvo, who's joining us as well. He's senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute, author of Government Against Itself, Public Union Power and Its Consequences. Welcome, Daniel DeSalvo.
My pleasure to be with you.
Glad to have you both. And Stephen Kreisberg, I'm going to begin with you. There is a good deal of legal precedence here, as we said in our last segment, going back 40 years. But there are many people who feel that the unions have gone too far in pressing political power. What do you say to that?
Well, I don't think this case is about the union's political power. I believe this case is about the power of the billionaires who are funding the challenge to a longstanding Supreme Court precedent. It's well known that the people behind the case are not employees. It's not public employees. It's the people who are funding the lawsuit. That includes the Koch brothers, people like Rebecca Mercer, the Bradley Foundation, which is a far right-wing foundation out of Wisconsin. These are all interests that are very, very much about suppressing the power of working people.
But the argument goes that working people have had a great number of benefits as a result of particularly Democratic politics and unions giving the majority of a lot of their political funds to Democratic candidates, and that that doesn't shake out fair. For we just heard a caller, for example, in the last segment say, you know, I feel sympathetic, I like good wages and everything, but what about the rest of us who aren't in unions?
They should join unions. I think ultimately what we find when we look at polling is about half of Americans do want to be represented by a union. Those of us who are in unions have nothing to apologize for. I mean, the idea that workers have too much power in the United States of America today is ludicrous. If we just have to look at the wealth inequality that has been increasing, income inequality has been increasing, both of those are correlated with a decline of organized labor over the last three or four decades.
And Mark Janus, the plaintiff in this, who says the fees pay for bargaining and lobbying of government, and he says unions are not the voice that is my voice, and unions are not fighting my fight. What do you say?
Well, Mark Janus is one of 36,000 state employees that AFSCME represents in Illinois. He's one. We have 35,999 others who aren't saying what Mark Janus is saying. Essentially, Mr. Janus has the right to his views, but he hasn't learned what most of us learn on the playground when we're in elementary school, that there is a certain amount of majority rule in this nation. We have a representative democracy that plays out through the labor unions. The workers themselves elect whether or not they want to have a union. Once they decide they have a union, they elect their representatives. Once their representatives start acting, the content of the collective bargaining proposals and the ultimate agreement achieved are both negotiated, ratified by a democratic vote of the members. So we are a very democratic institution. Mr. Janus may disagree, and he has a right to disagree. But what he really wants to do, with the backing of the billionaire benefactors, is to pull down the entire collective bargaining process because he disagrees with some of the positions we take.
So this is not a First Amendment issue, as you see it?
It's not a First Amendment issue at all. Mr. Janus does not pay a single dime towards the union's political agenda, such as to the extent that we have one. All of Mr. Janus's fees go to support the collective bargaining process and the administration of the collective bargaining process, which is about things like performance evaluation procedures, shift picks, vacation schedules, things that really are not about public policy and of public concern, but are usually just handled between employers and employees.
And let me go to Daniel DeSalvo. Daniel DeSalvo, this is, from your perspective, a First Amendment issue, is it not?
Oh, well, I definitely think there's a First Amendment issue. The court has decided this is the fourth case in 5 years touching on this question of the constitutionality of agency fees in the government context. So I think clearly the court, or at least some of its members, see this as a First Amendment issue.
Breaking with precedent, though, concerns people because this came up in the last segment, the value of legal stability. I mean, it was decided by elected representatives, and in many people's minds should continue to be decided by elected representatives, but at least ought to be forwarded because it's been going on for over 40 years and has been essentially reaffirmed many times.
That's certainly true. That's one argument. Another way of looking at any argument that begins from precedent is, I like what's going on now. We should keep it. It's a longstanding precedent. So certainly, there's lots of easy bad faith arguments to make in that way. But even if you go back and look just to the Abood decision, many unions throughout the public sector throughout the country operated without exclusive representation and operated even without agency fees successfully here, even in my home state of New York.
Is it, though, right that tax dollars, let me rephrase this, tax dollars often pay for things we don't like or we dislike, and somebody really needs to see it in that context, so the argument goes.
That's certainly another question. But here what's really happening is, obviously, if you can be taxed to pay for government speech that you disagree with, but this is a slightly different context, because really what's happening is public employees are being, in effect, taxed to support one side of the political spectrum. And in addition, if you are like Mr. Janus, you can't be forced to be a union member as a condition of employment, because that violates your First Amendment freedom of association rights. The result is, if you're not a member like Mr. Janus, you can't vote in union elections for union leadership, and you can't therefore influence the leadership's political decision-making or political speech. So in that sense, I think it's a much different context here. If all the public employee unions were doing was negotiating contracts, that would be one thing, but they're some of the biggest political players in state and local government, especially in the states where agency fees are legal.
Now, what about Mr. Kreisberg's argument, though, that the big political players are people like the Koch brothers, and that this is a political attack from the right for the most part?
Well, I mean, that's partly an ad hominem attack to change the subject and not engage with the arguments on either the First Amendment grounds or the political and policy arguments, and just say the people who are doing this are bad and their motives are bad, therefore don't listen to any of the arguments.
But what's your argument for a First Amendment right here?
Well, I think the argument for the First Amendment right here is that you are being compelled as a condition of your job to pay into an organization that is heavily involved in political activity. In, you know, New York here, public employee unions outspend almost all other interest groups combined on lobbying and electioneering. So in that sense, if you agree with all of their political positions, that's great, and you should be free to donate to unions and be a member if you want. But if you don't want to do that, there's no reason that you should be compelled to. There's not a reason here, like, if you think about it, as a condition of your job, you must donate to the Sierra Club or to the National Rifle Association. Pick your interest group, but in that respect, those are both providing public goods and benefits for which people aren't paying for. But I don't think there's another context in the American labor market where, as a part of your job, you have to basically support one side of the political spectrum.
Let me just get a quick, and if I could, cogent response from what you just heard, Stephen Kreisberg. And also, you might address the fact that public unions, some are saying may, as a result, if this goes through the Supreme Court as it's expected to, it would encourage them to maybe become a more social movement like they were back in the late 60s and early 70s, before such fees even existed.
Well, first, I'd like to clear up a number of the mischaracterizations that have just been made. First of all, nobody is contributing towards political activities against their will. If somebody wants to object to political expenditures on the part of the union, they get to withhold that portion of the payment to the dues that goes towards politics. Your previous guest, I think, went through that fairly well. This withholding of funds is not just an arbitrary determination by the union of how much is spent on politics. It's independently audited, and there's a process that employees can use to challenge the audit. So this idea that somebody's being coerced against their will to pay for the union's political agenda is just an outright falsehood, and it's a deliberate effort to muddy the waters. The only fees that anybody is required to pay are those that are germane to the collective bargaining relationship, which is, by its very terms, about conditions of employment, not about political matters. So let's clear that up, first of all.
Let me actually, before we go on with it, get Daniel DeSalvo to respond to that. Daniel DeSalvo.
Well, there's two issues here. I mean, on the legal question, Mr. Janus's case is that, in fact, all collective bargaining is inherently political in the government context, because ultimately decisions about how much to pay public employees, what their benefits will be, what the work rules that govern the day-to-day carrying out of their tasks is ultimately a political decision. So even contributing agency fees, if a line can be drawn between collective bargaining spending and political spending could be drawn, it's still political. I'd also say that that's exactly the legal argument here in this case, But also, because of the government context is what makes this different. Because in the government context, both the collective bargaining and the political activity are directed at the same source. So it's very hard to draw this neat line between what constitutes collective bargaining spending and what constitutes political spending.
Let me go back to Stephen Kreisberg. Stephen?
Well, notice the sleight of hand. A few moments ago, it was about the union spending money in politics. Now it's about everything we do is political in nature. But the Supreme Court has ruled otherwise. And just recently, this very same court in the Garcetti case has ruled that there's not every speech involving public employees is covered by the First Amendment. Government employers have a legitimate interest in regulating speech, right? This is why we have some data is considered classified data, right? Top secret clearances. If you have one, you cannot disclose things. You don't have a First Amendment right to disclose that information. There's a limitation on free speech. Free speech does not mean unlimited free speech. And the fact of the matter is the government has an interest in managing its workforce. And including in that interest is setting certain employment policies that for decades, if not over a century, courts have ruled that the government has a legitimate interest in controlling speech and having that speech between employer and employee not necessarily subject to First Amendment privilege. So I think we really have to distinguish between what is actually political spending and which is not political spending.
I think you're right about that. We've got a lot of callers who want to get in here, and I want to give them an opportunity to speak out and to raise any questions they have. But I did raise a question earlier, and I'd just like a quick response from you, because it has been argued that maybe this would get the public unions in a total different frame, and they'd become a social movement like they were back in the 60s or early 70s before these fees even existed.
Well, the unions do have a social agenda now, and whether or not the entire collective bargaining system will collapse, I think, is very speculative. Right now, we're very much focused on prevailing in this case, and even in the absence of winning this case, if we would happen to lose this case, we believe the collective bargaining system will survive. We believe that we will continue to have the vast majority of employees join with us. The concern is that over time, many workers will be tempted to become what we call free riders. If you can get something without paying a fee, why would you want to pay a fee? That's just typical behavioral economics.
That makes it almost certain that you would lose membership in the unions.
Yeah, I think over time it's clear that it will be very, very difficult to maintain the membership that we have now. But we're not conceding that we won't. We do have to connect with people at a greater level than ever before. More of our efforts will be spent doing so, and that will be to the detriment of some of the representation work we do. We accept that. If going forward we no longer have the ability to charge non-members their fair share of the fees that go to their representation, we're going to have to adapt. As far as becoming wider social movement organizations, that is certainly something that we would consider. It's certainly something we do now. We support many things that are not in the parochial interest of our members. And those things that we do support that are not germane to collective bargaining are not paid for by non-members. But yet our members believe in those things and want us to support them.
All right. We have a lot of callers, and I'd like to go to as many as we can. And I know Mr. DeSalvo wants more in here, but let's hear from our callers. Let me just mention one other thing. There is a compromise that's been put forward by Charles Fried of Harvard and Robert Post of Yale Law School that would reform the current law to make agency essentially for a service opt-out. And that would be presumably a complete opt-out. But let me go to our callers. Let's go first, Lisa, to you. You're on the air, Lisa. Hi.
Hello. Yes, I'm a union member. I belong to UPDI. I'm speaking as a rank-and-file member. I would just like to touch upon very quickly a couple of points. A caller said he resented the union members for getting health care and pension and all the things that he might not be getting. The question I would pose to callers who believe that is, why don't you have a union? Unions gave us the weekend. Unions give us health care. And the fact that this whole pension fund debacle, the reason why there's such an issue with the pension funds is because the Koch brothers, and this is not an ad hominem attack, it is proven that the Koch brothers, Mercer, and the American Legislative Exchange Council have an influencing politics by the billionaire side to try to take away whatever kind of benefits that workers have gained through blood and sweat over the years.
All right. That's a passionate response, and I thank you for it. Lisa, I want to get to more callers, but let me get Daniel DeSalvo's response to your passionate response. Unions are protected. People are protected in unions, and that's essentially the argument here. They need collective bargaining, and they need to enforce it.
Well, the question is just whether they need to enforce it by also coercing people who don't want to be members to pay into them and underwrite their agenda, even though those non-members can't vote, and you end up in this government context where a lot of the deck is in effect stacked against the non-member to determine how much of their dues are really being spent on collective bargaining versus being spent on politics.
Okay, we'll hear from some more of our callers. Let me go next to you, Al. Al, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been studying this issue for a long time. I'm not pro-union. I'm not anti-union. What I am is pro-worker. And there's an ideology among Democrat politicians that pro-worker is automatically pro-union and vice versa. And I want to say that's not the case. I worked at the University of California for 10 years. And I was there when Senate Bill 645, which imposed agency shop arrangement in California for public employee unions, went into law. Before that happened, the union reached out to represented employees and tried to get them to join the union. They listened to their concerns. As soon as that law went into place, all of that went away, and conditions got a lot worse. The union was not responsive. They just said, we're taking your money. You might as well join us. Anyway, and that was the extent of their recruiting. We tried to get them to do things that, to improve our workplace conditions, and we were never heard from again. So the agency shop arrangement actually was a detriment to our situation, not a benefit. And the fact that our union union dues were forcibly taken from our paychecks, and that we were that non-members who had their union dues taken for their paychecks were not allowed to vote in union elections. That's not fair share. That's taxation without representation.
All right, Al, I thank you. We'll let your comments stand. And again, we're talking with Stephen Kreisberg and Daniel DeSalvo about U.S. Supreme Court, which we'll be hearing on Monday, union dues, which certainly has raised a lot of hackles from labor and has raised a lot of concern. Bill writes, from my perspective, if employees do not want to pay agency fees even, let alone full membership fees, they should not be covered by a collective bargaining agreement and instead have to negotiate their own wages, benefits, and working conditions. Mary writes, when I was younger, I was required to belong to a classified employee union. My salary was already low, and paying union dues made my pay even lower. There is pressure indeed to join and not really a choice. Any comment from you on that, Stephen Kreisberg?
Well, I think people have different experiences with unions. I think, by and large, within our union, the experience is positive. We're proud of our accomplishments. We know what we've achieved for our members, and our members know what we've achieved for them. We have members who tend to be Republican, but yet they value our union and what we do for them. So it's not really a partisan Democrat versus Republican. It's a matter of being effective. And frankly, if the unions are not effective, employees, including the non-members, have the right to decertify the union. You only need 30% of your coworkers to sign a petition to force a vote and vote the union out. So it's not a case where something is imposed from the outside and you can't rid yourself of this. Unions are organizations of the workers themselves. And our experience tells us well over 90% of the workers want to be a part of our union.
Let me go back to Daniel DeSalvo, who, again, a senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute and author of Government Against Itself, Public Union Power and Its Consequences. How would Janus have impact here in California? Can you flesh that out for us a bit, Daniel DeSalvo?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say without knowing exactly the character of the court's decision, but assuming the court rules as many observers expect it to, which is to strike down agency fees as unconstitutional violations of the First Amendment, public employee unions in California could lose anywhere from 10% at the low end to, say, 30% at the high end of their members and revenue. As you know, the other guest has mentioned, unions are in a real concerted effort right now to shore up their membership and reconnect with their membership. Agency fees have partly allowed them to rest on their laurels, and some unions have lost connection with their members. So they're trying to revivify that connection now in order to stave off those kinds of both membership and monetary declines.
So what would you say would be the benefits, for example, in California, if Janus passes as is expected?
Well, one might look at just California, for example, has, you know, take the California Teachers Association, which is arguably the most powerful union in the state, which often makes politicians toe its line. It might provide some more flexibility for politicians to try to do other things to improve California schools that haven't been tried before because the unions blocked them.
I'm going to go to more of your calls. Let me read a few more comments. Jeffrey says, I've had to sign forms that disallow any social media posts concerning my place of employment. If compulsory union dues are against the First Amendment, wouldn't forms like that be as well? And Marcia writes, if unions lose, is it possible that there would be two-tiered employees, those with good benefits and wages who are supported by unions and those who don't pay dues and thus have lower income and who can be fired at will? Some serious questions here that are being raised. Let me go to more of our callers. Jennifer is next. Jennifer, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Egan. I'm actually the president of the California Faculty Association that represents CSU faculty in the state. And I just wanted to make it really clear, since Daniel DeSalvo muddied the water again about the political contributions that union members make, that is apart and separate from their dues. But it, speaking to unions as supporting social movements, the vast majority of our members do pay their political at the political action component of as being a part of their union, because they want to do what the union is advocating for. They want, which is not supporting Democratic candidates per se, but it is supporting public higher education and advocacy that protects our students. So that's really what unions are all about.
And you say what, Daniel DeSalvo, to Ms. Egan?
Well, I would say just look at the numbers on the public employee union contributions. AFSCME's contributions are 97% in favor of the Democratic Party. The California Teachers Association, basically the same. I think the data is very clear on that point. Now, it may well be the case that a majority of California professors and teachers and other employees want to do that, and they should have the right to do that. They should have the right to be union members and have the right to have the union spend its money as it sees fit. But that doesn't mean they should also be able to force others to pay into the union, because ultimately money is fungible. So even if you pay in for non-political, or at least nominally non-political purposes, that's going to free up other monies for politics.
What about that argument, that Stephen Kreisberg? Let me go to Stephen Kreisberg.
To,
I'm sorry.
I'll
go back to you, Ms. Egan. Let me go to Stephen Kreisberg first.
That is an outright falsehood. Okay, political contributions from the union are dedicated from voluntary political contributions by the members to our political action committees, which are separate and apart, as your caller noted, from dues payments or fair share fees. So, in fact, it is against the law for us to use our dues money, our membership dues money from members for political contributions. All political contributions to candidates come from voluntary political action contributions made by members, which are addition to their membership dues that they pay. So this idea that somehow we're taking dues money is an outright falsehood. I think DeSalvo knows that, and I'd really like to know why he's going on a radio show and lying. Now, either he's lying or he doesn't know better. In either case, I don't think you should have him on your show. I'll be quite honest with you about that.
Well, we're getting into kind of an ad hominem here, but I did say I want
to
hear
Well, when the man is going to lie to your listeners, what are we supposed to do? Not all opinions have the same weight.
Well, that's certainly
true. Opinions that
are truthful
should have weight.
Yeah, and I think Jennifer Egan probably is going to corroborate what you just said. Is that right?
Absolutely. What Stephen said, 100%.
All right, and let me go to you on this, Daniel DeSalvo. I mean, you've been called a liar, but other than that, how do you want to respond?
Other than that, well, we've got two union leaders playing hardball. What can I say? I think the obvious point is here, you wouldn't have an opt-out provision that allows non-members to say they want to opt out of political spending and get money that they've put in their agency fees back if part of it wasn't in principle being used for politics. Because if you're an agency fee payer and you pay in but you do not opt out, that is usually by writing an annual letter saying you don't want to contribute to politics, the unions can use that money for that purpose.
Now, let me read a comment from a listener who pretty much agrees with you in even maybe a stronger way. This listener writes, this is how the left swings elections. They give the unions freebies. The unions shake down members and pay off lefty politicians, a circle of corruption. And Harriet writes, this is heartbreaking. The decimation of the American middle class in slow motion. Selfishly, I fear that the ultimate goal is to end pensions for those receiving them, however long that may take to implement, and, of course, to eliminate pensions for current employees. So they have the real continuum of views. Let me get another caller on, and that's Richard. Richard, join us.
Yeah, Michael, I think the truth, too, again, will lie somewhere in the middle. I've been in and out of unions for my 50-year career in the workforce, and I'm in one now. I've been in them all over the country. And I have to tell you that the issue is that you are always, your union is always only as good as the local union members and administration is. They're a very different animal, many different places.
So you see that, you see complete variations in local unions, yeah.
Very, very much so. I'm talking night and day.
Yeah.
And the difficulty is that that particular thing, unless you go deeply into the local union yourself, is very difficult to change. I am absolutely in 100% in favor of unions. The difficulty becomes that just like any other organization, including many businesses, it can be corrupted by a few bad apples who see their way through it, who weave their way through it, and who make it their own. And the difficulty becomes that we become the monster.
Well, Richard, we're going to have to leave it there, but I thank you for your input, and I thank all of our listeners who called in. Unfortunately, we have to leave a whole full board of listeners here and many wanting to come and raise questions, but I think we've certainly raised a debate, and we have certainly brought it into light. The hearings will go on Monday. My thanks to Stephen Kreisberg, who again is Director of Research and Collective Bargaining for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, Daniel DeSalvo, who also joined us in this half hour, senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute, author of Government Against Itself, Public Union Power and Its Consequences. Thank you, Daniel DeSalvo.
Thank you.
And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you, and we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio and on the Forum program, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.